Good morning and welcome into Big Talk, College Sports with a Midwest Perspective, Blue Collar and Blue Blood. I'm Dalton Shetler. That's Sam Sprunger over there. Sam, there's a lot to get into.
There is.
More, here on this episode of Big Talk, because the college football season has now come and gone.
Thank goodness.
The Big Ten has the... Yeah. I mean, look, I love college football Saturday. Me too. But college basketball, there's nothing better than. So for us to be able to fully focus on that, bit of a relief there for me, as it is for you. But for college football, of course, the Big Ten ends up with a national champion. We'll talk about that a little bit here in a moment. Big Ten basketball, we're still trying to kind of figure out what's going on, because this last week just provided some more chaos.
Just muddied up the waters more, Dalton. That's all it did.
And I think it's all it's going to be until March. Like, I just think this is going to be a bit of a mess. But I think there's a lot to talk about there. There's a huge showdown in Big Ten women's basketball coming up tomorrow. Exciting. Iowa and Indiana playing in Bloomington. That's going to be a big game. There's a couple other big games in women's basketball, too. So we got a lot to get to. But I suppose let's start off with maybe the biggest thing. How you doing, Sam?
I'm okay. I was
that really froze you.
Yeah, I don't know how to respond to that because I've been better, but I'm not bad by any means. You know what I mean?
Well, let's get to the question. Maybe you were expecting Michigan wins the national championship over Washington in a game where it felt like Michigan in the first 10 minutes of it, you thought, oh boy, this one, we can go ahead, pack up, head home now, because it's like Michigan was dominating.
I thought it was going to be a 5-touchdown game.
The way
it was playing out.
Yeah. The way that started. And then Washington kind of hung around. You're waiting for them to connect on a couple of those shots. And it just never really came.
It did. Washington got called for a phantom hold. That one I texted you right after, because we talked about last week how Michael Penix Jr. can drop it right into a bucket, and I texted you and said, even though there was a penalty, that's the bucket you were talking about.
Yep.
And that play right there would have jumped. It was a 7-point game at the time. Had they not called that penalty, Washington was in the red zone after that play. And maybe, I'm not saying it would have changed the outcome of the game, because Michigan ended up winning by 3 touchdowns. Okay. Yeah. So, which in and of itself shocks me, but still not the point. I think it would have made it a much different ending had that hold not gotten called and Washington had an opportunity to try to maybe get going. They just never could get in a groove. And I commend Michigan for that.
Yeah, no, I think you're completely right. I mean, Michigan absolutely made Washington look like pedestrian. They haven't really all year.
Yeah, they looked like a pedestrian offense that did. They almost look Iowa-ish. Maybe not to the dumpster fire Iowa always was, but you get what I'm saying. Like, they couldn't do anything. They just couldn't get going, and Michigan's defense did a lot of that.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And so Michigan wins the national championship. Which it's interesting because there's folks in the Big Ten that still are upset about the cheating scandal. Some folks just don't necessarily love Michigan inside the Big Ten.
Mr. Baker from the NCAA needs to just not speak when he says Michigan won this fair and square. I'm sorry. It doesn't matter how much or how insignificant the cheating was. They didn't do it fair and square. Let's get those certain terms out. Let's say congratulations to the Michigan Wolverines for their national championship. Don't say they won it fair and square, because honestly, I don't think there's a program in the country, if they won the national title, could say we did this fair and square 100%.
Well, and given what we do know from this cheating scandal, like what already has been proven, and given the fact that we still don't know if Connor Stallions was on the sideline at Spartan Stadium for Central Michigan in Central Michigan gear. Like, that investigation has been going on for 3 months, 2 months, 3 months, 3 months now. Yeah.
And if that gets verified that it was him, then there needs to be even more talk about more ramifications to the University of Michigan.
So fair and square, I'm with you. That can't be it. Well, and it's interesting too, because Baker also went into saying that there's still investigations going on at the NCAA level on Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Right. So
it why step in front of it before you come to some conclusions? Like, that was just a really odd and bizarre statement to come out.
Well, it almost makes me feel like the NCAA has already decided they're not going to do a darn thing about it. So Baker's coming out to say they have more to conclude.
Like, there are still investigations.
I understand that, Dalton, but with him coming out and saying that before it happens, it makes me think they've already decided they're not going to do a darn thing about it. They're just going to say, we're investigating, and then years down the road, we found nothing.
See, my gut kind of leans with you too. And that's why, like, all this is super bizarre because it's contradictory, right? Like, for Baker to be like, yeah, we're still looking into the wrongdoings of that program, but hey, fair and square, got to tip the cap to the
BS,
the moral winners. Like, it's just, it's really bizarre to kind of,
as they I hand guess, the have trophy your cake and eat to it a too. Guy that sat out half a year for suspensions.
Yeah.
And mind you, the NCAA still has not punished Michigan for the cheeseburger incident. Still hasn't. So the
three-game suspension was self-imposed.
That was self-imposed because the four-game suspension is what the NCAA agreed upon and then said, nope, we're not doing it. We're going to do our own investigation. We're going to you know, bring up. So Michigan still could have some ramifications come from the cheeseburger incident, but not the Connor Stallions, because honestly, I'm not saying that's final. I'm just saying question mark, because they've already punished the Big Ten has already punished him
with the three game late
with the three game at the end of the season. So you can't do. I'm sorry, but honestly, I don't care how much comes out. I don't know that they can. That's double jeopardy in my opinion. You should have waited then. You should have waited to give him any sort of punishment. Don't bow down to what the Big Ten coaches are demanding, because you don't have all of it yet. Give him a full punishment. This is your first half, and then when we get everything else, you get another half. And that's not a fair assessment.
And I don't necessarily disagree, but I would pose the question then. We've seen so many times where something goes retroactively back for a punishment. Yeah. And if the Big Ten does sit it out, like, and not punish them at the end of that season, and they let this play out and then they drop the hammer, what does that hammer look like? And we still see, like, look, I don't think the NCAA is going to vacate it. I'm more concerned about if the NCAA does anything, not even as far as a vacate. Like, I'm really concerned, like, nothing's going to come of it. We still remember the confetti falling. Like, we talked about the game Monday night. Like, we still remember what happened there. And I don't think there's anything that's going to change that.
I don't know that I'm not even saying that they should vacate it. I'm just saying what they've done for less, the punishment they've given for less. How can they not further punish or give them a more harsh punishment for what they've proven that already that has happened?
So I guess my question would be, like, what do you have in mind as examples?
I mean, Louisville, granted, they had a whole plethora of stuff behind it. But when it came to on court, there was some money that was going through those players that shouldn't have been going through those players because NIL wasn't a thing.
Mm-hmm.
A cheeseburger?
Here's the comparison.
They vacated a national title for Louisville for that. And now, I mean, something that goes on the field with Connor Stallions, they're going to just give Jim Harbaugh a three-game suspension and that's it? I don't get it.
And I keep drawing back to, and I think there was an anonymous Alabama official that was quoted talking about this and said look at Kansas basketball.
FBI was investigating them.
A couple years ago, we had FBI wiretaps ready to drop the hammer. Nothing happened. Kansas was the national champions two seasons ago. Like, it's just kind of how this goes. And that's what, like, the official continued to say in that article, that everybody's cheating. He said everybody's out here cheating.
And
except
that by no means makes it okay.
I don't disagree, but he had said everybody's out here cheating except for Vanderbilt, and Vanderbilt sucks. That was literally the quote, which was unbelievably hilarious that Vanderbilt caught a stray like that. But good for Vandy for being clean. Yeah, but nonetheless, I don't know how necessarily you go through this, because you're right. Like, we do have instances where we've seen vacated titles between USC and football, Louisville and basketball. But given like what we just saw recently with Kansas, I keep leaning back to that, where we had FBI wiretaps proving that money was going to players as it illegally happened. I don't know what's going to happen with Michigan football. I don't know that anything happens with Michigan football.
I think we've seen it.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think we've seen it.
I think the only thing that throws this overboard is, I mean, obviously we still have to come to conclusions still on some of the video footage parts of this. But I think the big thing is, if you prove that was Connor Stallions on the field scouting opponents in a game, or helping opponents of a rival team in a game on the field, like, that throws this into another loop to see what comes from there. But beyond that, like, I'm not really sure that anything will necessarily happen to Michigan. And if I can make a broader point here too, Sam.
Sure.
Michigan 15-0, they win a national championship. They were the best team. I mean, they just were. They won it. They were able to, you know, just kind of force their will. But we have got to stop, I think, and I think nationally we have. I think it's maybe just the fan base and the prism. You saying that you overcame all takers and that you were able to climb this mountain of adversity and it was the world against you, it's not the case. It was all self-manufactured adversity. And I think, like, we need to be honest when we talk about this team. This team was a good football team. They won a national championship, and they were the best team. Like, that all makes sense.
They beat every team that was put in front of them.
Yep.
So they did what they needed to do to become national champions.
Yep.
But I get what you're saying, because they manufacture. Do better at cheating if everybody else is cheating. Do better at it. Period.
Well, and it's like, this isn't some kind of like Rocky story. Like, this isn't going to be a script that makes its way to Hollywood and say, what an inspiration. And I feel like that's a narrative that's been like kind of tossed out there. And no, like, you won a national championship, you beat everybody in front of you. That all checks out, makes total sense. But the idea and the narrative that this team just overcomes all the odds and the world was against it, it's just, I don't believe personally, from where I stand, that was reality. And I think a lot of people agree with that. I think it's a lot of people that are fans of a team.
Yep. Yep. I agree. The don't get, like you said, Michigan was the best team on the field Monday night when they played Washington.
Yep.
They showed that they were the only team that was good enough to win every single game they played this year, be it because they went to a bowl game that didn't matter and they had a bunch of transfers, opt-outs, whatever. Doesn't matter. They're the only team that went 15-0.
Mm-hmm.
So they deserve to be called the national champion because of what they did on the field as the players. Do not take a thing away from any of those players, even if they
knew
about
it.
Even if they knew about it.
Yep. No, I'm with you there. Okay, so we've talked a lot about Michigan. Is there anything else we want to discuss before we move on to some of the other areas?
I'm just taken aback at how well prepared Michigan was for that game, because I didn't see Washington being that pedestrian on offense. And don't get me wrong, minus the first two drives, the defense was pretty good against Michigan too. But I just was really taken aback by how aggressively pedestrian Washington's offense turned into when they went against Michigan. That is the biggest thing that I've seen saw the other night, because you expected a lot more from that offense.
I agree. It was shocking. And again, obviously Michigan's been able to bully a lot of teams in the trenches. Washington won the Joe Moore Award this year for the best offensive line, and the offensive line went toe to toe fairly well. It was honestly the other side when Michigan's offensive line was going against Washington's defensive line.
And what is it? Was his last name Dylan, or first name Dylan, the running back for Washington? Was it Dylan Williams or is his last name.
Dylan. I got to look again.
Whatever his day, the running back, he was not even close to 100%. He hurt himself against Texas. He'd been hurt all year leading up to that, to where he was never 100%, but he was good enough. And then he got hurt, which honestly, that was the reason why Texas even had a chance at the end of that semifinal game, was because he got hurt in the fourth quarter and he wasn't near 100%, but that's not taking away from what Michigan did.
Correct.
Against them.
Dylan Johnson was
Johnson. Thank you.
But yeah, no, I completely agree, but I'm with you. I was shocked to see what I thought was the best passing offense in the country this year. One of the best passing offenses we've seen since the days of LSU in 2019 with Burrow, Chase, and Jefferson. I don't think they were as good as Burrow, Chase, and Jefferson. I had a couple of conversations recently with some folks, and they're like, whoa, let's not make it the same. And
pump the brakes on.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not necessarily saying they were the LSU, but I think it's just about the best we've seen since that took place.
I agree.
And for what Michigan did defensively, I mean, tip of the cap. Well, hey, by the way, staying in college football for a moment, big breaking news this week earlier on, the greatest coach to ever do it. And
whether you agree with it or not.
And honestly, if you don't agree, I would love to hear your candidates, because when this news broke, I sat there, went through, and I tried to construct any kind of rebuttal to this. But Nick Saban, with 7 national championships, what he did for as long as he did, the impact he had on the game, the greatest coach in college football history, retired this week.
Well, and look what where he did it. He went to Michigan. He was at Michigan State, was extremely successful at Michigan State for a program that in the 60s and early 70s was one of the best in the country. Mm-hmm. It fell on hard times before Saban got there.
Yes.
And he started turning Michigan State around, and then went to LSU, won a national title at LSU, then made the famous, I'm not going to Alabama, got on a plane that, you know, 20 minutes after he said that, and flew to Alabama and took the job, and the rest is history. Like, he is, at least in modern history. I wasn't around for Bear Bryant. I wasn't around for, you know, the all-time greats, you know, Pop Warner, all those, you know, the old, but the new era coaches, Nick Saban is by far and will be by far, my opinion, the best, because, you know, you take Joe Paterno, he kind of bridged the two. So like a big portion of his wins weren't even in the Big Ten era of Penn State football. So, and so that to me just means that the new era is kind of like the 90s on.
Yeah.
And I would say that Nick Saban is by far the best. Bobby Bowden was great. I just, he didn't do what Nick Saban has and did do.
Think about it. 7 national championships.
6 at one school.
6 at one school. I mean, the second most is 6, and it was Bear Bryant. And right. Look, we often kind of take the more intellectual route when talking about this stuff, because I mean, honestly, comparing eras is difficult.
Sure.
But I think undoubtedly it's harder to win today than it ever was before, especially given the fact that you used to have years where you'd have 6 national champions because a writer felt like it. Like, so the idea,
they didn't play a system, they didn't have a system where they played it out. Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea that you win 7 outright, like it's just you didn't share. So many of those other coaches that are up there.
Wait a second. Was one of those the year that Central Florida went undefeated and claimed themselves as?
I think it actually was. Like one of them.
So he shared one.
Fair enough. But given all the different things for Nick Saban in the modern era, where there was BCS, there was college football playoff, to run the sport to the level he did, I don't know that we'll ever see it again. I mean, given especially now that NILs become such a thing and things a little bit more parity driven. Like, I don't know that we'll ever see an individual run the game for 20 years, 20 plus years, the way Nick Saban did in college football. And I just think it's honestly, you could compare coaches, not just with college football, but if we compare Nick Saban with other sports, Like, we're still talking about maybe the greatest to ever do it.
Yeah, I mean, his buddy might be the only one that that you could probably maybe say he ran his sport like Saban did, and that's Bill Belichick, who just recently left his position.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, the crazy thing was, is I was listening to the radio the other day, right after all this happened, and they said, you know what's crazy is Nick Saban took Pete Carroll's position at Ohio State when Pete Carroll left to go, and then Bill Belichick, like, they all have intertwined at some point on the same, you know, in the same programs and things, and they all within 24 hours do not have a job any longer, be it by choice or by force, or by force and choice.
It was one of the most wild weeks of coaching announcements that sports has ever had, given those names going away. And it's interesting. I know you got a point, but listening to the pool of candidates that is being rumored for Alabama's next head coach, and one of the big names was Deion Sanders. But Dan Lanning was one of the huge names, and then Lanning came out and said, "I'm staying Eugene, Oregon," and he's got something rolling there in Oregon.
To follow up Nick Saban.
Exactly my question. Like, that's the realization, because, like, think about
Deion Sanders.
You're going to have a ton of money at Alabama. You're going to have a ton of resources. Like, you have a lot to play with. But the idea of you following Saban, who was there, what, 15 years somewhere in that
17, ballpark? I thought.
17 years? That might be right. I believe
it was 17.
Yeah, 17 years and winning 6 national championships at Bama, 6 titles in 17 years, and how many other times he was playing in that championship game? Like,
nine of the 11 years the CFP was around, he's been in the playoff.
That sounds right. I mean, that checks out. So, like, to me, the idea that you have to follow that and that's the standard. Good luck.
The only one that I think would be brazen enough to say, sure, I'll do it, is Deion Sanders. Honestly, Lane Kiffin. Lane Kiffin too, because, you know, well, that's just it. He's been to was the coordinator at Alabama. So, like, he knows what it's like to be in Tuscaloosa and what the expectations are. Think of the pressure, though. You one screw up, you don't make that 12 team playoff next year, you may be gone.
And that's why I think some of those coaches like Dan Lanning have made a wise decision, because, A, they have momentum building at their programs.
Sure.
But,
plus, Dan Lanning's team's going to make a lot more money where they're going rather than the SEC and playing against Georgia and, you know, Florida and all these SEC teams that always seem to be rebuilding and having – there's always 3 to 4 teams that are having a better year than expected, and sometimes those are nationally better than expected.
Yeah.
And so, it becomes a lot harder
to
win in Alabama.
I'm with you. I think that's going to be interesting to see who actually ends up taking too, that job, because we've seen a couple of the big fish already say, we don't need to follow those footsteps. We're all right here.
Well, and you look at New England, they just announced today that Gerard Mayo is going to be the replacement. And a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, he's so young. He's the youngest coach in the NFL right now. But he's been on their staff for so long. Like, as soon as he retired from football, he was hired by the Patriots to be an assistant coach. So that tells me Belichick saw something in him and Robert Kraft saw something in him. I don't think Alabama's got that in the cupboard right now.
No.
But I have seen Lane Kiffin, Sarkisian as a possibility, and then Deion Sanders. That's the short list right now.
Which, if you're Sarkisian, don't you stay at Texas? You already brought Texas back, quote unquote.
I would think so, because you've got Ewers coming back next year. Why not stick around one more year at Texas? If Saban had waited until next year to do this, maybe Sarkisian has a different answer. But he also has Arch Manning on his bench.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got things rolling there, at least at the moment. And as far as I understand, like, to your point, like, with what the Patriots did, I saw a report out there on social media, and I can't remember who it was, so I can't give credit to, but I saw the report that Tommy Rees is the only in-house coach that is going to get an interview for this Bama position.
Oh, wow, really?
That's what I read.
That's the only one they feel comfortable enough. Now, how much say does Nick Saban have with this is my question.
Well, I thought
he's
saw
gonna too have an that, office.
Yeah, that he's moving into like a support role. And if you're Alabama, don't you say, hey, who reminds you of you? Like, pick one. Like,
who would you hire?
Yeah. Like, wouldn't you do that? So, yeah, I imagine that he voices an opinion somewhere in this process, because that only makes sense.
Well, and he was the one that hired Tommy Rees. So maybe that is the implication. He's the only one in-house that's going to get an interview. Maybe it's his to get. And if the higher ups, be it Saban and the rest, or the rest, whatever, decide, you know, this just isn't a good fit, then they go searching for Deion Sanders or Lane Kiffin, or really go hard after Sarkisian.
And Tommy hasn't been a head coach before. Remember, he was an offensive coordinator at Notre Dame, and then he was offensive coordinator at Bama for 1 year.
Like,
and now,
6 minutes ago, he was still playing for Notre Dame. What are we talking about? Like, he is an extremely young guy to be an offensive coordinator at a major college, let alone a head coach at a major college.
So
the major college, let's say it that way.
We talk about who the heck would ever want to follow Nick Saban after this. Imagine it being your first head coaching job in your career. Like, I don't know, like that to me seems pretty wobbly.
Unless they look at it as, you know what? Somebody's got to follow him. Somebody's got to follow him, you know, be it they don't succeed the way that is expected. At least that's the somebody following the legend, and then we can move on from there. But I don't think they want to be making this every three or four year thing to where they've got to hire a new coach.
Who would? I mean, he loves stability, right?
Right. Well, and that's why it drives you nuts that Nick Saban left. You know, like an hour before he announced he was retiring, he was interviewing coaches. Like, that's, and I heard him interviewed. He said, I just decided that I couldn't get up, go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, get up at 6 a.m. and still have the same fire that I had.
That Rees Davis interview where Rees asked how late he was going back and forth. And what day did this break? Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
And he said, I had the team meeting at 4, and I was still deciding as late as 3:55 which speech I was going to give the team. Wow. 5 minutes before walking in that room, he just was coming away with a conclusion to end his coaching career.
I'm telling you, he had that decided. He was just trying to make sure that that was the decision. You know what I mean? I think once you get that doubt, you have that, okay, this is something needs to change my mind from retirement. And I'm not saying he's lying. I'm just saying he had the decision made. He was just trying to come up with any reason for him to change his mind before he went and told that team.
Yeah. Well, hey,
I don't damn him at all. He went out on his terms. He went out on top. He was one play away from getting to the national championship game. One play.
Yep. I mean, it's an incredible career, and it's hopefully he enjoys retirement.
Does he? I've talked to a couple of people. One person thinks he's going to take Corso's spot.
I mean, I could definitely see him doing broadcasting now.
You think he'd be silly like Corso though?
I don't think Nick Saban
being silly. It'd be like saying Bill Belichick's going to be silly.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think he'd warm up more than we've seen him in the past, but to the extent of grabbing headgear and dancing with mascots and riding motorcycles into entrances, I'm not so sure.
I'm thinking he's more like Bob Knight, to where, you know, he was very rigid as a coach, but then once he got into the broadcasting and television, he did lighten up, but you could still tell it was Bob Knight.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that Saban will be much like that, because you know darn well, he may go on a vacation. We may not see him for a year, but then after that, we're going to see him all over the place, all over television. I don't think he can stay away.
No, I don't either. And I kind of look forward to it. I think the last couple of years has allowed a lot of fans nationally to actually kind of 180, going from hating Nick Saban to kind of admiring the excellence.
Minus the being the only two game, trying to make the argument last year that even though they lost two games, they were very, very possibly being the first two loss playoff team. Come on, dude.
Right.
Just accept that you're not making it.
Last college football piece of news I want to do before we switch to basketball. The College Football Hall of Fame class of 2024 was announced. And one of them, I mean, we talked about Nick Saban at Michigan State in the early days. Well, Michigan State's all-time winningest coach, Mark D'Antonio, is heading into the College Football Hall of Fame. I was going to say, and that felt like, obviously Michigan State fans and where I'm at, a lot of folks are very excited about this. But I think even across several fan bases, people have an admiration and respect for what Coach Mark D'Antonio did during his time at Michigan State, led with class, led with character, and was able to help Michigan State win three Big Ten championships, upset Ohio State a couple times, upset Michigan many times. Really,
probably the greatest ending of a game is the kick six.
I mean, it's
or the missed kick, a punt that he
the trouble with the snap. I was gonna say the kick six is the other one. Like those two, like it's A and B. Like however you lean. But I thought him getting the three Big Ten titles, becoming the winningest coach, everything he did, but also what he did for the players from an academic standpoint, from a life lesson standpoint, I thought this was very well deserved. And that was one of the moments that kind of warmed your heart a little bit.
Well, and what does it say about a coach when a university goes through something like Michigan State did with their previous coach, you know, that whole mess that it is, and they're still going through, but they fell back on a guy that retired to say, hey, we need you at least kind of, you know, come in and be a solid person to kind of help us get through this season. Anyways, it ended a dumpster fire. Don't get me wrong. It did not finish well for Michigan State. It just was a bad season overall, but it also didn't see a mass exodus of players during the season when you easily could have, because D'Antonio came in and helped smooth it over and say, look, whatever you end up doing when you get done with this season, that's fine. Let's finish what we started this year, then we can move from there. And I think he did a great job in doing that and bridging that gap to where they got their new coach.
I'm with you. And I think he's done a lot of things spiritually, again, academically, and helped reinstitute some of that in this year. So Coach Mark D'Antonio goes into the College Football Hall of Fame. Congratulations. Okay. Outside of football, are we ready to switch to basketball?
Always ready to switch to football when, or basketball when it's time, buddy.
So I don't know what to do with the Big Ten in men's basketball. I mean, there are so many weird scenarios going on right now. Let's start off with Nebraska for the fourth time ever, knocking off a number one team in the country.
Bumping a number one team.
Keisei Tominaga. I mean, he is just a fan favorite to watch. I mean, he's so much fun. But Nebraska beats Purdue there in Lincoln. What did you take away from this?
Well, if you looked at the picture that ESPN put up for their down goes number one, it showed how Nebraska guarded Zach Edey. When you wrap two guys' arms around both of his arms, it's pretty hard for a 7'4 guy to do anything in the post. Not making excuses, though, because it's hard to go to Lincoln and play. And when the refs let you play, like they did in Lincoln, you're going to get that and you're going to have to adjust. And Purdue just didn't do that. And Nebraska is not dog food when it comes to their roster, to what their expectations are this year. So A, it doesn't shock me that Nebraska beat them, but at the same time, Purdue's got to adjust to where, you know, like they played against Illinois and didn't have Edey into the game for a really long time because of foul trouble, but they still won because Trey Kaufman ran, played very extremely well, out of his mind. You know, all the secondary players stepped up and took over against Illinois. They didn't do that against Nebraska. Now, granted, you didn't have the home crowd like you did against Illinois, but still, you're a better team. You're the number one team in the country. You should be able to adjust.
Well, and here's what I find interesting too is, so I only got to see the very end of this game because I was at another Big Ten game this night and got home just to see the kind of finale of this. But I go in the box score. And look, you just mentioned it. Purdue is the better team. Purdue's the best team in the Big Ten. I think we can still in unison agree on that.
Still.
Yeah. When you look at Nebraska, they shot 61% from three in this game, 51% from the floor. When you look at how Northwestern beat number one Purdue when they did earlier this year, it took just about the perfect game. No turnovers,
right?
Hitting big shots. Like, look, that's what teams are going to have to do to beat Purdue. Like, they have to play their best game, and we've seen it twice now. I think, if anything, what this means is, A, you should be pretty excited for Nebraska, because I think Nebraska, with Fred Hoiberg, actually has a team that for the first time, like, you can make the tourney, you can do something special.
Nebraska's roster, and I think we even talked about that at the end of the season last year after they missed out. Of, like, you know, they have enough in there, especially if Tominaga came back, that you could see Nebraska being a pretty good team this year. I didn't expect them to be, 12-3 at this point, though, either.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's been impressive to start. And so I think that's the big thing is, you see what Nebraska can do with its best game, and its best game can beat Purdue. Like, that's what we learned. And I think, too, macro level for the Big Ten Conference, a lot of teams, like, they're just going to have puncher's chances against Purdue. But we've seen a couple of them now swing for the fences, and they've been able to deliver. Like, it's been really cool, because we just went through a football season, Sam, where, honest to goodness, we could have hit fast forward from the beginning of the season until the very end and not missed anything until the Ohio State-Michigan game. Like, we didn't even need to play a 12-game season. We just throw those two teams out there, let them decide who goes, whatever. In basketball now, you have a team that is supposed to be dominant, and I think is superior in talent and play right now, at least at this point, to everybody else. And we've seen them be upset twice in the first five games of the conference season. That, to me, makes it exciting for Big Ten basketball, because there's reason to tune in each night, unlike what we just went through with football.
The one thing that I think that helps Purdue, and yes, since I'm the Purdue fan, I'm gonna fall back to my fandom on this. The one thing that helps Purdue is both their games that they've lost are both legit road games.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to the tournament, there are no legit road games. So unless you're playing a 16 seed where they just keep hitting shots and you get all the random crowd cheering for them, you're not going to have an overwhelming crowd more than likely playing against you, or, you know, when you play. And I think that has some to do with how Purdue is affected. Welsh Ryan, is it Welsh Ryan Arena?
Yes. Yes.
It's small. Mm-hmm. So when you pack that full of just Northwestern fans, it gets very, very loud. Nebraska is the same way. They're not a huge, they don't have a huge arena, but when you pack it with Nebraska fans, it gets very, very loud and it gets disruptive. Just like going to Mackey is, Dalton. You know how hard it is to, to talk to the person next to you when you're in Mackey and it's jammed full and it's loud. I think with what Purdue's got, they've got two losses in their first five. They're 3-2, but both of their losses have come on the road in legit road games. And it took the team they were playing at home or on the road a perfect-ish game.
Yeah, and so I think you're right in taking that into consideration. If teams shoot 61% from three against you,
they deserve to win.
Like, you're going to have a hard time winning games. Like, that, it doesn't really matter how good you are. Yep. And, like, it's going to take teams' best games to beat Purdue, like we continue to say. But we've seen now two teams do it. And I think that makes it interesting, because honestly, what we're talking about here is the level of play from Northwestern and Nebraska were elevated. Like, this didn't sink down. We're talking about high competitive basketball in these two instances, which I think is pretty special. Hey, speaking of something special, with Nebraska, we mentioned that it was the fourth time ever that the Huskers beat the number one team in the country. It's the first one in 41 years that they've had.
No, it wasn't Purdue that time.
No, it wasn't. But one of the other ones I want to bring up, where they beat number one, March 3rd, 1958, they beat number one Kansas State. That's 66 years ago.
Oh yeah. I remember. Go ahead.
So
yeah, go ahead.
The coach at the time was Jerry Bush. And for folks who don't know, Jerry Bush is the grandfather of Fred Hoiberg. What a full circle family moment for Nebraska ball.
Yeah, it's a great thing. I just wish it hadn't come against Purdue. You know, I mean, I am, and you know what? I know a lot of people complain about it, and I know I mention it. You know, you're doing something right if you're Matt Painter, and every time you lose a game, you get the court stormed against you.
Yeah, he did mention that. And the only thing I'll bring up is that Michigan State fans took offense because they're like, we did not storm the court when we beat Purdue here at home. Which,
but they fair. Weren't number one at the time either, though.
Correct. But and I
but
do.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah, I just wanted to voice that because so many Michigan State fans have sounded
I'm sorry, up. But let almost me say, every time long.
I was going to say, but let me say the larger point, it, absolutely. Like, he's dead on. Rutgers, Nebraska, Northwestern. Like, the larger point is true, but I know many Michigan State fans were voicing their displeasure. Sorry. So
I was just laughing at, you know,
that. Indiana storming the floor.
Yeah. Well, act like you beat them before. Jeesh.
And if we all agree that Purdue is number one still in the Big Ten, I think it's an interesting conversation to ask who's number two right now.
Illinois.
Okay, go ahead.
The fact that, you know, and it stems from the Purdue game. They were down by 21. They could have easily just mailed it in and gotten beat by 17 because they fought back right at the end. And they made that. Now, the BS flagrant one or whatever that got called on Jones is... it helped get it to 3 points, but they got it to 3 points with less than a minute left. And that, to me, without your best player who's averaging 20 plus points and basically the cog, the hub to that team is no longer there. And they're still playing to this level. I don't know if anybody can touch Illinois at this point. Anyways,
well, it's interesting you say that because I got a team in my mind, and if I'm being transparent here, like, I'm 50-50. I can go either way between Illinois or this other team, Wisconsin.
They were the other ones that I was thinking about too. I agree, Wisconsin's, they're turning it up this year. Do you remember us talking before the basketball season even started, or way too early talking? We both mentioned Wisconsin never is out of the picture for too long.
Yep.
Last year they were. Is this the year that they come back? And it looks like that. You're right. It looks like they're back too.
Well, and we've seen Greg Garden, Wisconsin, win a Big Ten championship when that team had no business winning Big Ten title. Like, Wisconsin just will grind it to death. And this year, they're talented. I mean, they're good and they're deep. I mean, what AJ Storr has brought in as a transfer, Blackwell as a freshman playing so well, Connor Asijan still trying to find his way kind of into the rotation, finally got in and hit 4 threes a couple games ago. Like, if they start clicking even with him, like, the depth Wisconsin has, I think Wisconsin has a real run at being number two in this conference. And I'm not even taking anything away. Like, I'm with you. I think Illinois is right there too. I'm not really sure which way I lean.
I think it's 2A and 2B.
Yeah.
Those two teams.
I think it's a pretty razor thin margin at this point. But I think that makes it pretty exciting as well.
They're sitting both at 12-3. Minnesota's still 12-3 too. I don't understand.
Yeah.
Anyways.
No, I get
Minnesota
it.
Minnesota shocks me.
Yeah, no, me too. I did not have really many expectations at all coming from Minnesota, losing Jameson Battle and everything else, and for them to rally the way they have, that's been pretty exciting to see. Yeah. But what a weird time this is where we talk about who's number two in the Big Ten, and we say Purdue's one, Illinois maybe two, maybe it's Wisconsin two. Michigan State's just absent from the conversation at the moment, as they just dropped to Illinois and they're now 1-4 in Big Ten play. This is not a conversation I thought we'd be having before the season started.
Dalton, last week, I thought we had the conversation that we still felt that Michigan State was the second best team in the conference.
Yep.
And then they got beat by Northwestern, and then they played well against Illinois, but they lost to Illinois too. And they're sitting 1-4 in the Big Ten right now, tied with Michigan.
Yeah.
That's got to stick in your craw a little bit, right?
Oh, it does. And especially because, like, look, not to punch down or whatever, but Michigan is struggling this year. Like, I don't know if people are paying enough attention or any attention or whatever, or if they're just riding a high from football, but what's going on over with basketball, it's a tough situation right now for Michigan. But with Michigan State, I mean, you're right. Like, the Spartans went on a 4 or 5 game win streak that started with Baylor.
Yeah,
Baylor. Ooh. Yeah, and it ran them out of Detroit. And then you win a couple more non-conference games. A good Indiana State team comes in, you beat them. Penn State comes in as you rev Big Ten play back up. You thump them by like 30. And then you go to Northwestern, and then you go to Illinois. And here's the thing. The losses against Northwestern and Illinois, they're different. The one last night against Illinois, you can take some things away from. Like, Michigan State did some things well in that game. Mm-hmm. But the Northwestern game, effort was a question. And there's been too many times where effort has been a question for a Tom Izzo-led team. Like, I'm not sure that we've ever seen it quite like this. And we've never seen Michigan State 1-4 in Big Ten play under Tom Izzo. This is the first time this has ever happened. And this is, again, I go back to, this team has talent.
Yeah.
Like, I think without question, but like, there are some of those things that aren't always consistent. I thought the effort last night, and Tom Izzo said he thought the effort last night was really good at Illinois. But the problem is, if you're not bringing that night in, night out, the Big Ten Conference is too good. It's going to eat you up, as it has in different parts. Like, the idea of losing on the road to number 10 Illinois, not the worst thing in the world. Mm-hmm. But when you pile that on top of all the other losses you've had, like, that's where it becomes a big issue.
At some point, you got to think, when is the performance too poor to recover from? I mean, we've still got half a season left, and most of the Big Ten season. So, I mean, we're only a quarter of the way through the Big Ten season, so it's not like it's over by any means.
Correct.
But at what point do you go, oh my goodness, they're just not going to recover from this?
Well, and so that question, I feel like, was already existing a bit, and then they went on that win streak, and you're like, oh, okay,
there it is.
That's what we were waiting on. Yep. And then for it to flounder at Northwestern, it kind of just reared its ugly head, where you're like, what should we be expecting?
Right.
So I don't know. It's a big concern. And much to your point, I'm with you. Like, season's not lost by any means. You still have time to recover. I'm with you, though. Like, the clock is ticking on that. You want to make sure you're playing well. But I do want to go over the schedule for the next seven games for Michigan State, because this is going to kind of be the make or break. They get a couple of, I don't want to say easy, but it's not the tops of the Big Ten coming up here in the stretch. And Michigan State's going to need consistent effort, like, night in, night out, win these games, get back above 500 in the Big Ten. Like, this is a crucial stretch where they can, and talent-wise, probably should win these games, but they've got to be consistent with it, because they need these wins. Going through the schedule, Sunday, they're home against Rutgers. Next Thursday, they're home against Minnesota. Next Sunday, at Maryland. January 26th, at Wisconsin. That's a tough one. Then you have home against Michigan, home against Maryland, and at Minnesota again. Like, out of those seven games, Wisconsin right now is playing really well. But between what Maryland, Minnesota, and Michigan, I think those were the other three with a couple of double plays, and Rutgers, like, those teams aren't necessarily excelling. You've got to start clicking, gelling, like, now, win those games, and then, like, your season will end up being okay. But, like, this is a pivotal stretch, Sam.
Well, in Minnesota, we don't know what they are.
Right.
Yeah. Like, their big games comes tonight against IU at the Assembly Hall. If they can win that, Michigan State probably should start worrying a little bit about their games against Minnesota.
Well, and I go back to, like, the conversation we had with Purdue and some of these other teams.
Yeah.
Like, as of now, like, I mean, the talent Michigan State has against Minnesota, it's going to take a really good game from Minnesota. Not a perfect game, but it would take a really good game, which they've proven they're capable of.
Right.
But if Michigan State can, again, bring it, that's the question.
If they bring they did against Illinois, they're going to thump Minnesota.
Well, and that's the thing. And usually I think you can normally count on, maybe if execution isn't there, effort's always there. But that being a question in some of these games, that makes this concerning.
Right, right. And I don't disagree that this is their make or break seven games area. Now, granted, that still leaves eight afterwards. But if you go out of those seven games, you go 2-5, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot without much of a chance of recovering from
it. And that's exactly what I mean. Like, you're right. There is still another stretch, but if you don't take care of these seven games in front of you, like, you may just dig yourself a hole that's too big to climb out of.
You need to play as close to perfect during these seven games for you to be able to stumble a couple of few times in those harder ones.
Yeah.
To where it doesn't totally decimate you and put you in double digit losses, to where you've got to win the Big Ten tournament just to get to into the tournament.
There's still a home Illinois game in there. There's still a road trip to Mackey, a road trip to Bloomington, which even though IU, we're not really sure what they are either, it's still never easy to play
Chrysler
there.
Arena. It's hard to play at Chrysler Arena because it's of the rivalry, too.
I was going
to
say, if you're wearing Michigan State, it gets just a couple notches harder to play there.
Right.
But real quick, before we flip to women's, are there any other men's teams you want to hit on? I know we're running short on time.
The one thing that I was kind of taken aback by is the fact that you've got IU and Purdue sitting at 3-2, both of them, and you've got Nebraska, Northwestern, Minnesota, the three next teams above them. It doesn't make sense, and that's how crazy it is going to be, I think, and maybe the whole rest of the season. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's definitely interesting. Didn't see this being our conversation heading into the year, but
no, if you had Minnesota, Northwestern, and Nebraska on your bingo card ahead of Purdue in five games into the season, Big Ten season, you're a winner.
Let's go ahead and talk Big Ten women's basketball for a moment.
Yeah,
there's a couple of bigger games this weekend. Let's start with the biggest of all. Number 14 Indiana heads to Iowa City to take on the Hawkeyes. I think I might have flipped that around earlier in the show, so I apologize.
You said it was in Indiana. But
that will be a game later in the year. I had the location reversed though. So Indiana is at Iowa City. Remember what happened last year? It was the end of the regular season. Caitlin Clark had a buzzer beating game winning shot. Didn't end up giving them a piece of that Big Ten title, which was like kind of the chase heading down the stretch, but it was still an iconic moment in the Clark legacy. But Indiana comes in, and you look at the records, Indiana 14-1, Iowa 16-1. I think this should be a great game. That's tomorrow night at 8:00
on Fox. Yeah. Yep. I'm excited to see it. I don't watch a ton of women's games. I watched a lot of the highlights from them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one I will definitely tune into at some point. I've got broadcasting tomorrow, but I may DVR it and watch it because it's gonna be a really good game. I'm still loving the fact that women's basketball is transitioning into something entertaining to watch, and it's getting to the point where it's just as, depending on the matchups, it's just as entertaining as what you watch with the men's game.
Well, and here's something interesting too, is the accessibility. And I think that's changed a lot of,
I think that changes too. It. Yep.
Like you mentioned, this is on Fox, not Fox Sports, not Fox. FS1 or anything. Like it's on Fox.
FOS.
I think the Michigan Ohio State game earlier this year was on CBS. Correct. Next weekend, there's a game on NBC. If I remember right. Yeah. Iowa at Ohio State. Mm-hmm. That one's on NBC, not NBC Sports, not Peacock, but NBC.
Yeah.
So the accessibility is really changing in this too. And again, I mean, a lot of the talk and the eyes go to Caitlin Clark, and deservingly so. She's an excellent player. Like, sure. I mean, we've detailed that before.
That's not breaking news.
Yeah. Right. but honestly, even if you are just looking to get in or whatever, like, this is a good time.
For sure.
Big Ten basketball, women's basketball is really good. This is a good time to get involved and check out some of these games. But I did also want to mention this weekend, in terms of other big games, as I look around, Michigan State goes to number 17, Ohio State. These two teams are 12-3 on the year. That's a 4:00 tip on Sunday. And look, I understand I'm biased, right? I'll just be honest about it. I have an allegiance with Michigan State athletics and an interest there. Okay. But
we don't hold it against you.
But Michigan State has now moved to 2-2 in Big Ten play. They're under first-year head coach
Maryland.
Freilich, and that's, 74-69. They beat Maryland this past Tuesday. Yeah. It's the first time they've beaten Maryland in 5 years. It snaps a seven-game losing streak against the Terps, and it's only the third time they've ever beaten Maryland in the program history.
Holy cow.
Congrats. Like, yeah, when you're talking about what Michigan State women's basketball is doing, between that win, between going to Penn State and beating Penn State, and Penn State got ranked for the first time in about 8 years this year.
Yeah.
Going to Iowa and taking number four Iowa, now number three, the third best team in the country, to the very end. It took a buzzer beater game winning shot from Caitlin Clark to beat Michigan State.
Like, what, the 40th shot of the game?
The 34th.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. But for a 40th point, like, no, I mean, for real, what Michigan State is doing here under first year head coach Robin Fralick, it's worth watching because, too, if you also take the context, last year, the leading scorer was Kamaria McDaniel. She graduated.
Right.
Matilda Eck was the second leading scorer. She transferred to Virginia Tech. Tyer Parks was the fourth leading scorer, but she was the leading forward, the post player for Michigan State. She transferred to Ohio State. So it's actually a bit of a reunion this weekend with Parks and Michigan State. But you take all those players away, and then you get into this year, and a couple weeks in, Gabby Elliott gets hurt for the rest of the year. Isa Alexander gets hurt for the rest of the year. So there's no true post players left on this Michigan State roster. And then because Mary Meng also gets hurt and is out for the rest of the year, the 6'5" freshman. So you have all these injuries piling up. You're down to a rotation of about eight players. I mean, sometimes they get to eight, but for the most part, it's just seven players. And they've banded together to again, beat Maryland for the first time in 5 years, take Caitlin Clark to the very wire, beat Penn State at Penn State when Penn State's having a historic season in their recent history. Like, look, again, if you're just getting into women's basketball and you want to follow one of those teams that just has a togetherness that radiates and is easy to root for, a bunch of underdogs, this is a good team to pile in on. Like,
if you
don't
want to be called a bandwagoner, jump on the East Lansing team.
And look, I do think the future is very, very bright in East Lansing, but what this group is doing is a seven-playing group, eight-playing group, going through the Big Ten and what is one of its best years in its history of women's basketball. It's pretty cool stuff to take in. So that's my pitch to you.
Big game on Sunday as well, an hour before your Spartans take on Ohio State. Nebraska goes to Minnesota. Both of those teams are in the top five of the conference as well. Nebraska sitting at 4-1 behind Indiana and Iowa. So like they're performing much better and a lot better than they did last year. But they've got a lot in the cupboard. They're playing, and Minnesota's 2-2. They're 12-3 overall. Nebraska's 12-4. So that's a big matchup there too.
No, agreed. And Nebraska, that's the other team that Michigan State lost to in the Big Ten besides Iowa. And they nearly came back against them, but the Huskers look really good. You really wondered how they'd be because they had a couple season-ending injuries before the year. But they're Jazz Shelley and Alexis Markowski. It's a pretty good duo. I mean, they're a fun group to watch too. They just survived a win against Illinois, which Illinois women's basketball has been an interesting story. They rose to the NCAA tournament last year, brought a lot of that core back, and you expected similar things. And right now they sit, let's see what their record is, 6-8 on the season. But yeah,
0-4 in the Big Ten. Like they're night and day compared to what they were last year. That's not to say they can't recover from that though either.
Right. But yeah, much like how we had the conversation in men's basketball about trying to figure out some of these teams, we're having that conversation on the women's side as well. But
I'm excited for this the rest of the season. I say this almost every episode, but I really am excited about it.
No, and again, like, look, you can, much like us, you can be a fan of both men's and women's basketballs because there's some great ball being played both ways. But with all that being said, Sam, go ahead. And as we head out the door, let everybody know where they can find us.
Yeah, well, on the TikToks, the Instagram, and the platform formerly known as the Twitter, you can find us at B1G_talk, B1G Dalton, not B-I-G underscore talk. You go to Facebook. It's B1G Talk, Big Talk. Do not look up all Big Talk. Well, you can look it up. Just don't click on them. Click on just the Big Talk that comes up when you search it. We're on the ASAP network every week at 9 a.m. And you know that because it's 10 o'clock now and we're wrapping it up. But then you can find us later as a podcast or as a video stream. later through Lounge Media Group. If you want to watch the video, you can go to Spotify and watch us there. But that's where you can find us.
Perfect. Well, everybody have a big Big Ten weekend. Thank you all so much for tuning in and joining us. That's Sam Sprunger. I'm Dalton Shetler. So long, everybody.
See ya.